everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if, like us, you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me. As always, thank you all for the support so far on the podcast.
Please follow, share with your friends and write us a review, only if it's a good one, of course.
This week, we are talking about a story that takes place in 2006. Here are a few interesting facts about that year.
The number one song that year was James Blunt, You're Beautiful. Iraq's leader Saddam Hussein was found guilty of crimes against humanity and sentenced to death by hanging. Number one movie in cinemas was Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, starring, oh, my favourite, Johnny Depp.
Before we get started, just a quick disclaimer. Obviously, this is a true crime show, and we discuss serious crimes, sometimes involving violence and sensitive topics. We do aim to balance respectful storytelling with light-hearted commentary and a bit of humour to keep things engaging, but rest assured, the humour is never at the expense of the victims or their families. So if you're here for bad jokes, interesting stories, and mine and my mum's very silly sense of humour, then please stick around. Viewer discretion, and maybe a sense of humour, is advised. Right, everyone, let's get on with this week's episode. This is the story of the mysterious death of Ray Rivera. On May 24th, 2006, Ray Rivera's body was discovered at the historic Belvedere Hotel in Baltimore, Maryland, under even more mysterious circumstances than you could ever imagine. The official ruling left much to be desired, and the more we look into the facts of the case, the more puzzling and unsettling the story becomes. Was Ray Rivera's death a tragic accident? Did he take his own life? Or was there something far more sinister at play? Before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. Ray Rivera, known as Ray by his family and friends, was by all accounts a man with a promising future. Born on the 10th of June, 1973, Ray was raised in Southern California in a close-knit family. He was a creative spirit, a writer, filmmaker, and a lover of sports. Ray dreamed of making films one day, and after graduating from UCLA, he started building a career in screenwriting and video production. Ray was a larger-than-life person, quite literally standing at 6 foot 5 inches tall. It's quite tall, that, isn't it?
It is.
He was ambitious, had a love for storytelling, especially in film, and was working on a screenplay at the time of his death.
Can I just say, before we go any further, don't you think that's a lovely name? Ray Rivera.
What's that thing where it's like two words with the same letter in a row?
Alliteration.
Alliteration. It's a nice alliteration, isn't it?
It is. Ray Rivera. It's got the ring of a star to it, though.
In 2005, Ray married his longtime love, Allison Jones. The two were deeply connected, a couple described by friends as inseparable. After their wedding, the couple relocated from Los Angeles to Baltimore, Maryland. This move was driven by a job opportunity for Ray, working for his close friend, Porter Stansberry. Why is Stansberry funny?
Because in my head, I keep saying, Porter Pickleberry.
But why do you keep saying Pickleberry?
Porter Pickleberry it's that thing.
Alliteration.
It's alliteration. I just love alliteration, so.
Stansberry was a successful financial publisher, and his company, Stansberry & Associates, was known for giving investment advice and predictions to high net worth clients. Porter and Ray have been friends since college, and this job allowed Ray to write newsletters and help produce financial reports. Despite his love for filmmaking, Ray took this job as a means to support his family while he pursued his passion projects on the side.
I don't think Ray liked doing this job though, because I'd heard something about this before. I think it was on the Netflix documentary. And I believe he was supposed to be writing like some kind of financial report, and he wasn't comfortable with it because he felt like he was misrepresenting some of the information for the good of the company. So felt a little bit, I think, like he was conning people somewhat.
Yeah, I think even just, I mean, we're only like one paragraph into the story, but you can already tell that it's not obviously a job that he wants to be in. He seems passionate about filmmaking, so it's the complete polar opposite of filmmaking, isn't it? Writing financial reports.
I think he felt somewhat obligated to his friend as well, you know, because he'd known him for a long time and he'd given him this opportunity, so he was trying to do the best job he could, but I don't think his heart was in it really.
Well, he was probably also just doing it to make a bit of money so that he could maybe, you know, fund some of these passion projects that he had going on.
Yeah.
By all outward appearances, Ray was a happy, motivated man, madly in love with his wife, getting settled into his new life on the East Coast, and ready to take on his next creative endeavour. However, in the months leading up to his death, those who knew Ray said he had been acting unusually. He seemed anxious, stressed, and at times paranoid, though no one could pinpoint exactly why this was. This, as you'll see, would become a key factor in the mystery surrounding his death. At approximately 6:30 p.m, Ray was at home when he received a phone call. What happened during that call remains one of the most significant and bizarre mysteries in this case. The details surrounding the call are sparse, but it reportedly came from the offices of Stansbury & Associates, the financial firm where Ray worked. At 9:30 p.m, Allison called her co-worker Claudia, who was staying at the couple's home at the time. Claudia told her that around 6:30 p.m, she had heard Ray answer the phone call and respond with a simple, "Oh," then rush out of the house, leaving behind most of his personal belongings. He rushed out to the front door without telling anyone where he was going or why. At 5 a.m. the next morning, Claudia called Allison to say Ray is still not home. Knowing this is completely out of character for him, Allison immediately drove back to Baltimore, calling hospitals, police, friends and family looking for Ray. She also filed a missing person report.
I think from what I know of this case, what was even more unusual about it was the fact that Ray obviously didn't say where he was going, but immediately left the house. And I believe he was wearing flip-flops. So it was something, you know, that he was just wearing around the house. And also, he had some kind of dental brace because he was getting his teeth straightened. You'll identify with this actually at the moment. And he'd left that house as well. So, you know, he was intending to come back. It was just a spur of the moment thing, you know, someone had rang him with whatever was said on the phone to get him out of the house, and he just never came back.
Well, it sounds like he wasn't even prepared to leave the house at all.
He wasn't expecting this call, clearly. It sounds like an urgent phone call, doesn't it? Someone phoned you for something that needs to be done immediately. And another strange thing was, I believe he was eating a bag of crisps.
How would you know if he was eating a bag of crisps?
Because I'm sure that's what it said in the Netflix documentary, but what flavour crisps, really?
Oh,
that's
my what I'd God, like not to know. These again. Well, to be honest, Mum, it seems like you know more about this case than I do, and I've done the research.
I don't know the answers, unfortunately, but let's carry on.
For over a week, there was no trace of Ray whatsoever. His family, friends and wife were beside themselves with worry. Flyers were posted all over the city, and private investigators were hired to assist in the search.
And also, I think that Alison, his wife, had set up like a command centre in their house. So all the relatives came in from all over the place, because Ray had a brother, didn't he, as well, I think. And they were all there, and it was like an operation almost, you know. I think they were doing a better job than the police at this point.
I think once a missing person's taken seriously, that usually happens, doesn't it? They usually set up a base somewhere. They have searchers going out every day. They hand the missing person flyers out.
Yeah, this was the family, though, that were doing this. I mean, you know, the police were doing their own thing, but the family were just, you know, they were the ones that were sort of like at the forefront of it.
But then, on the 24th of May 2006, a grisly discovery was made. After several days of searching for clues on his whereabouts, Ray's in-laws and co-workers found his car located in a parking lot off St. Paul Street in Baltimore's Mount Vernon neighbourhood, which was near Stansbury & Associates, where he worked.
So it was actually, was it his mum and dad, did you say?
It just says his in-laws.
Oh, so it was Allison's mum and dad. That's what they were doing. They were driving around and around, you know, trying to locate where his car was. And it was them who actually found it, not the police. That's what I'm saying. It was the family who was doing all this.
But I find it a bit weird that it took them a whole week to locate his car. If it was found near where he worked, surely that would be one of the first places that you would go and check.
When they say it was near where he worked, though, I think it was a couple of blocks away, I think. And it's quite a big area, really. And if it's lots of, you know, if it's a car park, they're massive, aren't they? There's hundreds of cars in them, and cars move about day by day, so it could have just been sort of hidden in there, and they've driven around and, you know, kept going back, and as I say, cars are moving around, so maybe it was easier to see at that point.
There was a parking ticket left on his car which showed that the vehicle had been parked there since the 16th of May, the day he disappeared. I need to do that one more time.
What am I trying to say?
Just read the thing, Josh.
I just keep thinking pickleberry. There was a pickleberry on his car.
There was a parking ticket left on his car, which showed that the vehicle had been parked there since the 16th of May, the day he disappeared. They searched the area where the car was discovered, which was at the top of a parking structure, when one of Ray's former colleagues spotted a hole in the second floor conference centre attached to the historic Belvedere Hotel. So from what I understand, connected to the hotel was a flat roof conference room.
So that was part of the hotel, yeah.
It was linked to the hotel, and then attached to that conference room was the parking structure.
Like a multi-story sort of thing.
Yeah, so if you stood on top of the parking structure, you could look down and you would be looking at the roof of the conference centre, which is where they've seen this hole.
That's a bit of a coincidence though, isn't it, do you think? Or is it? I don't know. I mean, just imagine being up there and then you look down and see this.
Well, I don't see it as a coincidence, to be honest, because I think if you're searching, you're looking everywhere and anywhere, aren't you? To see if you can see anything.
Yeah, probably. But, I mean, to look down and then see a hole and think, why would you even think that hole has anything to do with anything?
Well, you'd probably just say, what's that hole? It was an odd, jagged hole, too large to be caused by something falling from a small height and too irregular to be the result of normal wear and tear. After investigation of the roof, they made a grisly discovery. Ray Rivera's body was found lying inside the room, partially decomposed underneath the hole. He had been dead for days, but the circumstances were perplexing from the start. The Belvedere Hotel was once a luxurious grand hotel, but by 2006, much of it had been converted into condos and office spaces. The room where Ray's body was discovered was part of a disused area, not easily accessible by the public. The parking structure in which his car was discovered was connected to the Belvedere by the conference room where his body was found. But the real shock came when investigators realised how Ray ended up there, at least according to the initial theory. Above the room, there was a small rectangular hole in the roof. The Baltimore police quickly hypothesised that Ray had somehow jumped or fallen from the top of the hotel, which was 14 floors high, crashing through the lower annex roof and ultimately meeting his death in the conference room below. Ray's injuries were consistent with a fall from a great height. He had suffered severe trauma, broken ribs, punctured lungs, and fractures to his legs and skull. However, some experts have said they believe his injuries to be more consistent with being hit by a car, and one expert said there was a case in which more damage was done to a man's body who had jumped from the 8th floor of the Belvedere Hotel previously than to Ray's body who had supposedly jumped from the 14th floor.
So there was less damage to him despite the fact that he was supposed to have jumped from a greater height than to this other man who jumped from the 8th floor?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you can... I don't know if there's any way to prove that that's possible.
I just find it strange that they're saying that the injuries were more consistent with being hit by a car, which makes me think that, are they suggesting that something else happened to him and then he was dropped through the roof, you know, other than just falling through the roof, and that's what caused his death?
Well, it seems to me that they've jumped straight to the conclusion that he's jumped or he's fallen from the roof. I don't think they're really taking any other options into consideration.
Well, if there's a hole in the roof and someone's gone through that hole, I think it's logical to think that they've probably jumped or fallen through.
I think it's also good to note that they keep describing this hole as small. And as we know from the beginning of the story, Ray is not a small man.
No, but I think when something drops, I'm not a physicist, obviously, but if something drops from a great height, if it's something heavy, do you know what I mean, and it's coming down, doesn't it leave a smaller space because it goes through quickly and the weight of it will take it down or something like that? I don't know. Or is that wrong?
No, I think you're right, but a lot of this will make sense very soon. The hole in the roof was unusually small, just big enough for a human body to pass through, but not typical of damage caused by such a long fall. So this again is just what we've just said about him being a... Well, it actually says just big enough for a human body to pass through. I'm assuming that means a human of average size. He is not an average sized human. He's 6'5", around 220 pounds. That's a big, big man.
Would this make a difference though, that, you know, actually when you fall, you know, if you fall like a starfish sort of thing and your arms out, as opposed to like if your arms are up, would that make it, that would make a difference surely to the size of hole that you're going to create?
Yeah, well, I think again it says unusually small, so to me whatever's gone through that roof has been quite streamlined in the way it's gone through. I think if you were to go in like a starfish kind of position, you'd probably take half the roof with you.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Surprisingly, certain items found near Ray's body seemed oddly intact. His flip-flops were broken but in decent condition. His mobile phone was found unbroken even after an alleged fall from over 14 stories high, and his glasses were found fully intact. How could it be that his body was so damaged, yet his phone and his glasses were virtually untouched? Here's where things get really strange. The roof of the Belvedere Hotel, as we've said, is over 14 stories high. The trajectory required to land in that specific room raised many questions. The gap between the roof of the Belvedere and where Ray landed was about 43 feet. For Ray to have reached that distance, it would have required him to either take a running leap off the building's roof or be propelled somehow. And remember, Ray was wearing flip-flops at the time. Was it even physically possible for him to make such a jump?
I don't think so. Not 43 feet.
43 feet?
From the edge of the building.
Is a long way.
He'd need to run up, wouldn't he? And then jump 43 feet out.
And again, this is going back to what you said about the position that he would have had to hit the roof. If you're jumping like that, there's no way you're going through a roof in a straight line, feet first.
No.
There's just no way.
No, definitely not. You actually running towards the edge as well, if he's wearing flip-flops, you know, that's going to be difficult in itself. And then to jump that distance off the edge, I mean,
you're either going to go forward or you're probably going to go backwards. I mean, you're not going to go through the roof vertically, maybe by chance, but seems to me like you go more forward or more backward if you're trying to jump that far.
Is it even physically possible to jump that far for a person to jump 43 feet?
Well, after a quick little Google search, it says the men's world record for long jump is 8.95 metres.
And how many metres is 43 feet?
43 feet is 13 metres. So it basically means that Ray would have to run, break the world record for long jump in a pair of flip-flops.
So plus another 4 metres?
Well, and he would still be 4 metres short of the world record.
That's ridiculous.
And then there's the matter of how long Ray had been there. The decomposition of his body suggested that he had died shortly after his disappearance, but no one had heard the sound of him crashing through the roof, nor was anyone able to explain how no one had noticed for 8 days. Equally confusing was how Ray would have accessed the Belvedere's rooftop in the first place. The hotel's layout was a bit all over the place, and getting to the roof required navigating through a series of locked doors, elevators, and staircases. Yet no one had seen Ray at the hotel that night.
I think the hotel wasn't it a mixture of, some of it had been turned into apartments and things, and there was a lot of security cameras about as well.
Yeah, so originally it was a hotel, and then they converted, I believe, half of it into apartments, and there was also some like restaurants and cafes and things in there as well, so there was a lot of people going in and out of the building.
But also, more importantly, for him to access the rooftop, he would need to go through people's apartments, I think is what they were saying, to actually get to an exit to get onto the roof. Or even, as you say, through restaurants, but probably through the kitchens and things as well.
But people will have had to have seen him, regardless how he got to the roof.
Somebody would have seen him if he took one of those routes, I think.
There was no surveillance footage of him entering the building or taking the elevator. It is believed that Ray frequently visited the A1 bar, which was on the ground floor of the hotel, and no Belvedere employees, residents, or customers in the lobby, restaurants, or bars saw Ray, or anyone that looked like Ray, in the Belvedere at any time on the evening of the 16th of May.
That's very strange, isn't it? That there was all these people about, and they would have recognised him, I think.
Two bartenders who knew Ray and were working on the evening of the 16th of May said they did not see him either. None of the Belvedere video camera recordings placed Ray inside or outside the building on the same evening. For whatever reason, the Belvedere roof cameras were disconnected or not working on the 16th of May, but had been working the day before on the 15th and were working the day after on the 17th.
What's the chances?
That's a bit dodgy, isn't it?
It definitely is.
There seems to be no witnesses whatsoever. No witness to him coming off the roof, no witness to him going into the conference room, and no witness to him coming into the hotel off the street. It begs the question, how did Ray get to the roof and why was he even there?
This is one of the strangest things I've ever heard, really, because obviously to get off the roof, he must have been on the roof at some point. Or was he on the roof?
Well, that's what it's saying, that no one ever actually seen him on that roof. So it's all just speculation.
There's another point as well, because I think to get onto the roof, if he was going to jump off, there's like ledges and things, and it's very, really high up and difficult to access those ledges, which are outside, I think, the apartment blocks and things. To walk along those ledges, even to get into a position to jump with...
Well, not even to walk along them, but to run along them at the speed that he would have to jump as far as they say, and he's jumped. It just doesn't seem realistic. And also, I did read in quite a few different sources that apparently he was scared of heights as well. So his wife was saying he would never have been up there anyway because, yeah, apparently he was scared of heights.
Well, I'm scared of heights. And I wouldn't... There's no way you'd get me near the edge of any building. I mean, I can't even go up a ladder.
With Ray's body now found and the bizarre circumstances surrounding his death, several theories began to emerge. Let's break them down one by one. Okay, so the first theory is obviously suicide. After Ray's body was found, the Baltimore Police Department initially leaned towards the theory of suicide. They argued that Ray may have been suffering from some sort of personal or professional turmoil and chose to end his life by jumping from the hotel's roof. But this theory immediately faced skepticism from Ray's family and friends. For one, there was no history of mental illness or depression in Ray's life. His wife Allison insisted that Ray had shown no signs of distress in the days leading up to his death. He was working on a screenplay, and while his job at Stansbury & Associates wasn't his dream, he didn't seem troubled enough to consider ending his life. But again, you know, it did say at the start of the story that some of his friends were noticing that he'd been acting a bit different leading up to his death, so whether he was just putting on a bit of an act for Allison.
Well, the word they used was paranoid, and I think that's different than being depressed. I think paranoia sounds like he was worried about something, that there was something going on in his life that nobody else knew about, and maybe he was trying to shield Allison from it. Wasn't there something about a break-in at the house or an attempted break-in at the house just days prior to this or the week before? It was something like the alarms all went off in the house and Allison said that Ray jumped up and he was absolutely petrified. It was as if he knew something that she didn't know.
Yeah, so apparently they'd been living in this house for about 6 months and the alarm had never gone off. And two nights in a row, the alarms went off. It says that on the first night, when Allison woke up, Ray had already jumped out of the bed and he was holding a baseball bat. And she said she's never seen him looking so scared. And apparently, according to his friends and family, he wasn't as scared of anything. So obviously that was a bit of a surprise to her to see him looking so petrified.
It was almost, by the sound of it, that he was expecting something. Like someone was after him or he knew something that Allison didn't know.
It also says on the second night, the alarm went off again. And when they inspected the windows, it looked like one of the windows had been tampered with from the outside. So maybe something was going on that he hadn't told Allison about.
I think definitely something was going on. That's pretty scary, really. And he kept it to himself, which, if you look at it logically, I suppose the suicide theory might apply. Maybe there was something going on, he couldn't sort it out, and he thought that was the best way out of it all. But he doesn't sound like that kind of person to me, so I don't think it was suicide.
And also, surely there's an easier way to do it than that.
I don't think he'd do that, being so scared of heights either.
Theory number two is that it was an accident. The next theory is that Ray may have fallen accidentally. Could Ray have been exploring the roof or trying to get a better view of the city when he slipped and fell? It was discovered that Ray had previously been to the roof of the Belvedere Hotel to watch a sunset, and on the day of his disappearance, he'd visited a website showing when the sun would set in Baltimore. While this theory seemed plausible, there was one major problem: the distance from the main roof to the hole in the lower conference room. It seemed highly unlikely that Ray could have fallen there by accident without extraordinary force or intention. So that kind of goes against what we were just saying about him being scared of heights. And I wonder if he actually did go to the roof to watch a sunset, because if you were scared of heights, that wouldn't be on your list, would it?
Well, I wouldn't be going up there. But the thing is, you're not going to go right to the edge to see the sunset, are you? You might be able to go up to the roof and, you know, a good way back and watch the sunset, and that might be acceptable. But he's not going to go right to the edge to watch the sunset, is he?
No, and I also think the main problem with that theory, which to me just means that it's not even possible whatsoever, is the fact, how can he fall 43 feet out from the roof?
Yeah, that's impossible.
Well, we've kind of discovered that you can't really jump that far either with you trying. So if you were to slip and fall, you'd probably fall about 3 foot from the roof, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and there's no way. He wouldn't go near the edge like that. He just wouldn't do it.
The third theory is foul play. One of the most intriguing aspects of Ray Rivera's death revolves around his connection to Stansbury & Associates and his longtime friend, Porter Stansbury, or as my mum says, Porter Pickleberry. At the time of Ray's death, Stansbury's firm was embroiled in controversy. The SEC had filed charges against the company in 2003 for defrauding investors with false stock tips. Stansbury had been ordered to pay $1.5 million in fines, but the lawsuit left a cloud of suspicion over the business. Some theorists believe Ray may have discovered something at Stansbury & Associates, something dangerous enough that cost him his life. And it seems to me that this is quite plausible, to be honest.
I think this, out of the three theories, is the most probable.
It's important to remember that the call Ray received just before he disappeared, when he ran out of the house, came from Stansbury & Associates, but we don't actually know who from.
But surely, even then, they would have been able to trace that back to a specific department or something.
Well, I think they did do call records to, like, they tried to trace the call record, but it was just coming up as the offices of Stansbury & Associates, not like a specific person or room within the offices or whatever.
But because his friend owned that firm, as Ray's friend, wouldn't he have made it his business to ask around and find out where that call came from?
This is the part that I find really interesting. The firm invoked their legal right to remain silent, and Porter Stansbury, once Ray's close friend, refused to cooperate with the investigation. This only fueled suspicions that Ray's death might have been connected to something more sinister at Stansbury's company. And I think rightly so.
That's definitely strange. As his friend, he should be doing everything he can to help the authorities solve the case.
I mean, why would you not cooperate? You only don't cooperate if you're hiding something.
He's definitely hiding something, his pickleberry.
While the police lean towards the suicide theory, many believe that Ray was murdered. The circumstances surrounding his death are simply too bizarre to accept the idea of a simple suicide or accidental fall. One theory suggests that Ray may have been asked to come to the Belvedere Hotel under false pretenses, perhaps to meet someone for a business deal or a secret meeting. Once there, he was forced or pushed off the roof, and the hole in the annex roof was staged to make it look like suicide or an accident. This would explain why Ray's personal belongings, like his phone and glasses, were so undamaged. If he hadn't fallen naturally, these items might not have been subjected to the same violent forces as his body.
But that doesn't really make sense either, does it? Because even if he was forced or pushed off the roof, they'd still have to push him or force him 43 feet out from the roof.
And yeah, that's a hell of a push.
Yeah, they can't. That's not going to happen.
But I think the fact that his belongings were not undamaged, but his body was, might lean into more the idea that something happened to him, not even anything to do with the hole in the roof, and he's been placed in that room, and they've made the hole to try and cover up something that's happened.
Yeah, that's more like it. So what you mean is he's been killed, and then he's been put in the room, and then they've put a hole in the roof and put his belongings there to make it look as if he's fallen through there.
Yeah, and apparently some of the belongings that weren't, you know, smashed to bits were found on top of the conference room roof as well, and they weren't all in the room with him. So, I mean, you could argue that maybe they've been placed there, or maybe they did fall out while he was falling.
Well, if you wanted to make it look like someone had fallen through a hole in the roof, I would imagine that you would put some things on top of the roof. And I think his flip-flop was torn. But whether that was done in another way, I don't know.
And I've read multiple different things, to be honest, about this conference room. I've read that it wasn't easily accessed by the public, and you could only get to it through the hotel. It was like a disused part of the hotel. But I've also read other things, that there was this basement that you could go through via the car park, with, and there was a staircase leading up to this conference room.
That sounds quite likely, because in these big old hotels, which it's that type of hotel, there's usually all kinds of underground passageways and things, isn't there, you know?
So I guess he could have been placed in that room.
Well, he could have been, yeah.
Without coming through the roof. So there's no actual definitive evidence to support any of these theories, to be honest. There's no witnesses to say that they ever saw Ray at the hotel or on the roof, and there's no clear signs of a struggle in the room if anything was to happen in that room. So the question is, why was he at the hotel?
Well, he was at the hotel, I think, because of the phone call. Did he actually go to the hotel, or was the phone call to get him to go to somewhere else, and then he was taken to the hotel? But definitely somebody wanted him to meet whoever it was somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah.
For
I think
some
that's
reason.
The key thing.
And I think the reason was definitely to get rid of Ray, for whatever reason. And I think it was because he knew something, and it's all connected to Porter Stansbury's company.
Yeah, I think I'm leaning more towards that as well. It seems to me like it's got something to do with this Porter Stansbury guy and some dodgy dealings going on.
let's go through the theories one by one. So suicide, he would have to be able to jump the 43 feet away from the side of the roof.
Well, it's not that, is it?
No, so it's definitely not that. He couldn't do that. Even with a big run, he's not going to be able to jump that far. He's not an Olympic jumper, is he? So, number two.
Accidental fall. We can write that one off straight away.
The same thing applies. And the thing is, he's not going to be up there because he's scared of heights. And that's for both of those theories. So that then only leaves us with the last theory, which is foul play. And you've got to look at all the facts of the case before then.
Yeah, so basically all of this started from the alarms going off in the house, the weird phone calls. It all started from when he started working for his friend.
Yeah, and the fact that he was paranoid. And people around him obviously picked up on this. He wasn't his usual self. So had he discovered something within the company and somebody found out that he knew something, and then Ray actually knew that he was in danger in some way? It all adds up, doesn't it, though? And then he gets this call, but what was this call? What made him go out of the house that day?
I think that's the golden question, isn't it? And that's something that obviously they've never been able to find out, and what no one knows.
What could they say to actually get him to go to the place they wanted him to go? I guess we'll never know.
And I think also, we can't forget the fact that he's not someone that you could easily overpower.
I was just thinking that, you know, because he was like huge.
He's a big, big man. He's 6'5", like I said, 220 pounds. That's not a small human being. So it's going to take a couple of people to overpower someone like that.
But if you think of his injuries as well, they were saying it was consistent with a car crash.
Well, it was consistent with him being hit by a car.
Or hit by a car, sorry. Yeah, so could those injuries also be like the result of an attack or a fight as well? You know, a similar kind of thing, or...
I would just love to know if they have murdered them elsewhere, why have they gone with this option of placing them in that conference room, making a hole in the roof? It's just so random.
Yeah, what relevance did that hotel have? I mean, there was a theory, I think, about it that I read that was saying that he was killed elsewhere, and then they dropped his body from a helicopter, which, you know, is consistent with the hole in the roof thing. If he was dead, do you know what I mean? He's just going to go straight down, isn't he, straight through. But I don't know why they need to go to all that trouble. But nobody actually saw him in the hotel, though. That's the key thing. Was he even ever in that hotel, apart to be placed there after he was dead?
Okay, so obviously we've discovered that this is a really bizarre and strange case anyway, but this, for me, is probably one of the strangest things in the whole case. The handwritten note found taped behind Ray's computer at home. When investigators searched Ray and Allison's home after his death, they found a cryptic note taped to the back of Ray's computer. The note was folded up and tightly packed into a small space, almost as if it was meant to be hidden. It included references to movies like The Game and Seven, which, if you've seen them, they're both psychological thrillers about elaborate games and conspiracies. There were also names of famous people who had died, and even a list of Freemasons. This sent conspiracy theorists spiraling into overdrive. The contents of the note were cryptic, to say the least. But the biggest question was, what did it all mean? Was this a note a suicide letter, or was it something else? Investigators and even Ray's closest friends struggled to make sense of it. There was no overt reference to suicide or any explanation of what Ray might have been involved in. But it certainly pointed to the idea that something strange was going on in Ray's mind before his death. Investigators initially dismissed the note as the ramblings of a creative mind, but many of Ray's loved ones believed it held a deeper significance. Allison, Ray's wife, said Ray had recently become fixated on secret societies and conspiracy theories. Could the note have been connected to something Ray had been researching, or was it a clue to something darker? To this day, the true meaning of the note remains unclear. The first line of the note begins, "Brothers and sisters, right now around the world volcanoes are erupting. What an awesome sight. Whom virtue unites, death will not separate." And that last sentence, his wife Allison randomly just put it into Google and it came back as a Masonic phrase. Now that is a bit bizarre, isn't it?
I find it a bit of a coincidence that, you know, all these references to Freemasonry keep popping up everywhere.
Ray's wife Allison also said that she could tell that he'd written the note on the day of his disappearance, because there were scraps in the trash can, and she said they weren't there on the day that she'd left to go to work. So why would he be writing that on the day that he went missing? And then he gets this random phone call.
It's like almost as if he was trying to leave clues without actually saying anything. I mean, why would you write a note and then hide it, though?
Well, if he was trying to leave clues for people, he's made them a bit too impossible to decode.
Yeah, but...
And as far as I'm aware, the full note has actually never been released to the public. There's always parts blurred out or things censored, which says to me that there's some information in there that might be of evidentiary value. What do you think about that then? Because I know you love a good mystery.
I do. Well, because Ray was a screenwriter and was obviously maybe developing some ideas for films that he'd like to make, I don't think that's too far-fetched to think that, you know, he could have been doing that. But also, he may have been involved in some kind of Masonic group or...
Yeah, I mean, I actually think it's just a big coincidence, to be honest, that they've found this note. I don't think it actually plays a part in his death.
I actually don't think it's a coincidence. I think the fact that it was hidden for a reason. But I think the whole, you know, Masonic thing is could be linked back to Porter Stansbury because...
Sounds like you've got it in for old Pickleberry.
Pickleberry's going down. I just think with all these strange things that were happening to him before, it was all a little bit underground and shady, and I think this kind of Masonic theme could be plausible.
I mean, again, like the rest of the case, there's no concrete evidence to suggest that this has anything to do with anything, to be honest.
No, but you know, these secret groups, you know, they're all sort of...
They have weird ways of messaging and all kinds, don't
they? Yeah, exactly. So, and if you find something out you're not supposed to find out, you know...
You gotta go.
That could be the end. I can't understand why they never went and explored the company more.
I think the bottom line here is, I think we're both on the same page and we're both confused why they didn't investigate or push it more with Porter Stansbury.
Well, it's all very well saying that, you know, they invoked their right to remain silent, but surely when one of that company's employees goes missing and later turns up dead, they've got every right to be able to look into their records and things to see if there's any connection.
And I think they've got every right to be able to invoke their own powers to say, I know you're saying that you're going to stay silent, but there's a dead body here and we want to investigate you further.
That's exactly what I've just said, Josh.
Is it?
But in a different way.
Oh.
I'm glad to see you agree with me, though.
I mean, this story is just full of mysteries, but that, for me, that is one of the biggest ones because it's the biggest thing that happened in the story that was new in his life. He moved to Baltimore with his wife to start this new job that he'd been offered by his close friend. And all of these tragic chain of events have only happened since he started working at that company.
You know, when you think about it, it's almost like a film script, which is ironic, really.
It is ironic. The Baltimore Police Department officially ruled Ray's death as undetermined, neither fully closing the door on suicide nor foul play. But many, including Ray's family, felt the investigation had been incomplete. One major point of contention was the hotel's surveillance footage. The Belvedere had security cameras installed in key areas, including the roof, yet investigators claimed that no footage of Ray entering or leaving the building was ever recorded. This has led to significant speculation that key evidence may have been lost, hidden, or destroyed. Almost two decades on, his wife Allison has been relentless in her pursuit of justice. She has never accepted the idea that Ray took his own life, and she continues to push for answers. I think, like we were saying, you know, it seems to me like the police have just jumped to the conclusion that he's committed suicide, and they've kind of just tried to hammer that home from the beginning.
I think they want to just close the case in the easiest way possible. But I think Allison, if I remember right, was actually warned, and I think it was by somebody within the police department, to be careful, because obviously there's dangerous people involved. But what that means, I don't know.
Maybe the police actually know something about this Porter Stansbury and his business that other people don't.
Which could link back to the whole Masonic thing, because, you know, a lot of those people are in high places all over the place. So it could be like some kind of, you know, web of conspiracy, couldn't it? One covers for another is what I mean.
Yeah. And I think they're obviously siding with the suicide theory, but you've got all of his friends, all of his family, his wife, saying he wasn't depressed and that he just would never do that and he would never take his own life. And I mean, I'm sure everyone says that, but it just seems so bizarre.
I don't think... It doesn't ring true because he just got married and there was a whole future to look forward to, and I think him and Alison were planning a family as well. So for that reason alone, I don't think that's a plausible theory.
In a 2020 episode of Netflix's Unsolved Mysteries, Ray's case was featured, reigniting public interest. The episode brought new attention to the unexplained details of Ray's death, and though it didn't lead to any breakthroughs, it revived discussions about the potential conspiracy or foul play behind his death. But after 18 years, the case still remains unsolved. Was it suicide? Was it an accident? Or was it a carefully staged murder? Despite the theories, the strange details, and the incomplete picture, Ray Rivera's death continues to baffle everyone who looks into it, including us now as well. Ray Rivera's death remains one of the most perplexing and haunting cases in modern true crime. It's a story filled with unanswered questions and mysterious clues. Perhaps one day we'll know the truth. Until then, Ray's story serves as a reminder that some mysteries, no matter how carefully we examine them, continue to defy explanation.
Okay, everyone, so I think that's one of the strangest cases you'll ever hear, and one you're not likely to forget in a hurry. And that's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thank you as always for listening, and we hope to see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time,
don't do the crime.